This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit amazon.com/prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out.
Welcome to New Books in Religion, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Lindsay Jackson. Millions of tourists visit Holocaust museums and memorials every year. Holocaust tourism is a thriving industry and plays a crucial role in Holocaust memorialization and remembrance. However, Holocaust tourism is not without criticism. Some argue that sightseeing at sites of mass genocide is cringeworthy, offensive, inappropriate, and superficial. In Postcards from Auschwitz, Holocaust Tourism and the Meaning of Remembrance, Daniel Reynolds examines the phenomenon of Holocaust tourism, its implication on Holocaust remembrance, and what we can learn from tourists taking selfies at Auschwitz. Postcards from Auschwitz transports the reader to a variety of museums and memorial sites around the world to unpack the phenomenon of Holocaust tourism. Daniel Reynolds is Seth Richards Professor in Modern Languages in the Department of German Studies at Grinnell College. Hello, Daniel, and welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, Lindsay. Thank you for having me.
So Postcards from Auschwitz is somewhat of a divergence from your previous research. What made you want to write a book on Holocaust tourism?
That's a great question, a fun question to reflect on. The reason for turning to this topic really comes from my own experiences as a traveler, as a visitor to sites of Holocaust memory that I began in earnest about 11 years ago or so as part of my position here at Grinnell College. I had an opportunity to participate in a faculty development trip to sites of Holocaust memory in 2007. And part of that travel involved a lot of planning and discussion about where we would go, what we would see, and what would be the appropriate ways to engage with the places that we saw. And in the course of our discussions, I noticed this recurring motif, that was that we were really anxious to reassure ourselves that we were traveling to these sites not as tourists, but as researchers or as educators. And I was really intrigued by the difference or the implied difference between those two identities. And I wanted to really think hard about why is it that we are so quick, generally speaking, to avoid the label of tourist, particularly in the context of something as serious as the Holocaust. On one hand, it's obvious. It's a very serious topic, and tourism is usually associated with what is frivolous or superficial. But I was also very aware of the fact that we would be, in every visible way, showing up as tourists. We would arrive on a bus when we went to visit the Auschwitz-Birkenau Memorial. We would be walking together in a group led by a guide. There would be an opportunity to get refreshments if it was very hot outside and we needed something to drink. There's a bookstore on the site. So there were all kinds of questions I had about what it means to be a tourist or a visitor of any kind to a place like Auschwitz in particular. That was sort of the starting point. And this led me into a field that I was previously not very familiar with, and that's the field of tourism studies, which I found was really helpful in helping me begin to think about this question about what it means to be a tourist. And it also presented an opportunity to think about other ways of approaching Holocaust memory and representation. So my own field is in really in literary studies. And I wanted to think about tourism as yet another kind of medium through which we encounter or represent the Holocaust, and saw here an opportunity to maybe apply some of the interpretive strategies of literary studies and literary analysis to another kind of cultural phenomenon, namely tourism, and see if it would be possible to wed some of the insights that Holocaust studies and in particular have developed over the years to the phenomenon of tourism to Holocaust memorial sites. So that is really the impetus for writing the book. And it's a question I still engage with. And it's not necessarily a settled topic for me, but I still find the question of the notions of various kinds of identities that one has or associations one has with tourism to be a fascinating topic, and especially in the context of the Holocaust.
You mentioned early in the book that more than 2 million people visited the Auschwitz-Birkenau Museum and Memorial in 2016. And other Holocaust museums, such as Yad Vashem in Jerusalem and the United States Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C., welcome similar numbers of visitors on a yearly basis. Why, in your estimation, is Holocaust tourism so popular? And who visits if you can sort of give me an idea, who in general visits these types of memorials and museums?
That's a great question. I think there are a number of reasons for why these destinations, and these three in particular, I think, so Yad Vashem in Jerusalem, the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum in D.C., and Auschwitz-Birkenau in Poland are especially heavily visited sites. There are other sites that are important to Holocaust memory in the experience of the Holocaust that are less frequently visited, that are far more remote. I'm thinking in particular about some of the other extermination camp sites like Belzec and Majdanek, or not less so Majdanek, but Belzec, Sobibor, and in particular. But that aside, these places, I think, are have become very central to the various national narratives that are played out at each of the locations. So the USHMM in Washington is informed in a very important way by its placement on the Mall in Washington, D.C., among all of these other landmarks. And it's a space where Americans imagine and engage with their history in an evolving way. And so the question about how the Holocaust is remembered in the American context or the Israeli context or the Polish context are becoming very interesting questions as the memory of the Holocaust is becoming more and more global. I think there are a number of other factors. I think it's also the case that there's an awareness that we are entering a period when the last living witnesses and survivors of the Holocaust will depart, and we won't have the same kind of immediacy to Holocaust lived memory that we currently have. And I think that's lent a sense of urgency on the part of many people to visit these places, as if to go to the place where it happened could somehow compensate for the impending loss of direct lived memory. I don't know if I answered all aspects of your question.
Yeah, no, you did. You did. Another thing I want to talk about is the title of the book. You use the image of a postcard as an emblem of tourism, which explains the title, Postcards from Auschwitz. Tell me a little bit more about the image of the postcard and why it is representative of the tourist experience.
Sure. So I think, again, I think one of the things that I remember from my first visit to Auschwitz in 2007, something my colleagues and I talked about was the sort of surprise that there were postcards for sale at the site. On one hand, that surprise seems kind of naive in retrospect. Of course, there would be. Any kind of memorial site that a museum also needs to have ways of bringing in additional proceeds and also people still want souvenirs of places they visited. That seems very strange to talk about that in the context of the Holocaust. So that kind of discomfort around a very common tourist practice in the context of a very profoundly disturbing place was one of the impetuses for the choice of postcards as the image for the book. But I also think that postcards are more complicated than meets the eye. I think there's a way to look at the kind of postcards that are for sale at Auschwitz. I spend a little bit of time in the book talking about the typical aesthetic one encounters of postcards for sale at Auschwitz, which usually involve spaces that are empty of any human beings. So there are usually no human figures in the postcards. It's just an abandoned landscape. That represents a kind of forlornness and also the remoteness of the event into the past. But the other side, other aspect of postcards that I think is worth thinking about is the way that people inscribe the back of postcards. And so a postcard is an opportunity to vouch for one's having been to a place, but also in a sense for one to inscribe that memory with their own agency, so to apply their own words to the experience that that they've encountered. And I think this is very important in the case of Holocaust tourism, because I think it's an event that is so heavily represented and so overdetermined by so many different necessities that it can be overwhelming, I think, for many people who are trying to engage with the Holocaust to figure out what the right response is or what can one say that could possibly be meaningful. And postcards are an opportunity to do that, to make some moment, have a moment of reflection on the site and inscribe the memory that one has onto onto some remnant from that site. So I think I wanted to get at the ambiguity of the phenomenon of Holocaust tourism, both the unavoidable commercial dimension of it. Tourism always has these commercial connotations, and I think for many that is a disturbing aspect of the phenomenon of Holocaust tourism. But you can't separate that commercial aspect from the other more subjective possibility for individual tourists to use postcards as a way to engage with their memories.
I'm wondering if you could elaborate on the history of Holocaust tourism. When did the first museums and memorials, when were they created? And then when did Holocaust tourism start becoming popular?
Yeah, the earliest Holocaust memorials and museums really were the liberated camps. These were often the result of efforts by survivors who wanted to preserve the places of their torment so that what had been experienced there would not be forgotten by future generations, and that the perpetrators would not go unpunished. So that was certainly the case at Auschwitz. Actually, prior to which was opened as a museum within 2 years after its liberation in January of 45. Even prior to Auschwitz, the Majdanek camp outside of Lublin in Poland had been established as a memorial site by the Red Army in 44. I don't have the book in front of me at the moment, but or that particular page. But so there was already a determination to preserve these sites as sites of education and evidence for future trials and for history before the World War II came to an end and while the Holocaust was still unfolding. After the war, Warsaw had the Ghetto Heroes Memorial established very, very early on after the war as well. The early years of sort of Holocaust memorialization were local efforts for the most part. So efforts by local communities to remember lost loved ones, to lost neighbors. But the phenomenon of tourism to these sites, that's a little harder to speak about. I think in the early years, taking again Auschwitz as an example, the first visitors to the camps would be Polish school children in school groups going to the camps, or members of the military who, for whom a visit to the camp was part of their training to sort of expose them to the evils of fascism and expose them to the benevolence of the Red Army that liberated the camp. And so there was a definite ideological bent to tourism to sites of Holocaust remembrance from the very beginning. Also, the same could be said at Dachau, although that wasn't open as a camp until much later, that these all of these sites were embedded within the context of the Cold War. And in because of the Cold War and because of the difficulty of traveling across the Iron Curtain, it was really difficult to imagine a kind of global tourism practice that could easily cross from one border to the next. And that all really changed in the 90s with the collapse of with the end of the Cold War, the opening of the Berlin Wall, and the opening of the borders between Eastern Europe and Russia and the West. And so I think the ability to access these sites was a major impetus to present-day tourism, the era of mass tourism. And that's when you see the numbers of visitors to places like Auschwitz or some of the other camps, also to Warsaw and the ghetto ruins, when you see those numbers start to climb dramatically. I think of Holocaust tourism, which really began to take off in the 90s, as one more piece of what other scholars like Andreas Heusen have called the memory boom, which started in earnest, I would say, in the late 70s. Many scholars date it with the airing of the NBC miniseries Holocaust, which began a public discussion about the Holocaust in the United States in ways that had not taken place before. And then a couple of years later, it was shown in Germany, in West Germany, with the same kind of impact in terms of opening up public discourse. So so the entry of the Holocaust into kind of public discourse almost guaranteed that tourism would be sure to follow behind very soon. And that's what happened.
Holocaust tourism and creating public memorials at sites of mass atrocity is not without criticism. And one of the harshest critiques you share in the book is that of historian Tim Cole, who likened the Auschwitz-Birkenau Memorial and Museum to, and I'm quoting, a Holocaust theme park. Why do Holocaust memorial sites and museums elicit such strong reactions, and are these criticisms fair?
Sure. I think that's a question that I continue to wrestle with. I think one has to take those criticisms very seriously. I think that they come from a place of concern about the nature of Holocaust memory and the unavoidable aspects of tourism that bring commercial considerations to bear. I think it's just impossible to ignore that. Tim Cole is not the only person who's made that comparison by any means. Even Art Spiegelman, the designer of Maus, has made the comparison of to Auschwitz as with a theme park. My own response to that that charge is that it, at least in my experience and in the experience of many of the people that I've spoken to who travel to these places, their experience is not the experience of a visitor to a theme park. I think at root in this discussion about Auschwitz as a theme park is the question of authenticity. And to call a place like Auschwitz inauthentic, which is, I think, the gist of what the theme park allegation really does, is, I think, doing a disservice to the nature of the site, the kinds of memorialization and preservation and education that do take place there. I don't want to pretend that everything is perfect at these sites in terms of how they are memorialized and preserved and presented to the public. So I think there are, particularly at Auschwitz I, the so-called Stammlager, the first part of the camp that was opened prior to Birkenau, there are national exhibits in several of the barracks buildings, and each exhibit tells the story of Jewish prisoners at Auschwitz, deportees to Auschwitz from that country, and that national experience of the Holocaust as it played out in Auschwitz. And some of those exhibits have been more successful than others, but it does lend there's certainly a thematic structuring of the visit to Auschwitz that if one wants to think of theme park in that sense. But I don't find it in any way hokey or inauthentic or dishonest. I think it can be very educational. It's developed, so these barracks are kept up to a certain kind of standards, so they're safer for so many people to visit. The exhibition has to be visible and legible, so that necessitates some alteration of the site to lend itself to tourism. But then one goes to Birkenau, usually after the visit to Auschwitz I, and one sees a far less developed place, a place that really is a landscape of ruins. Most of the barracks were dismantled after the war, and there are some barracks that remain. Some of them are facsimiles reconstructed to give people a sense of what they would have looked like during the Holocaust nearly 80 years ago. And there is some restoration work being done at Birkenau, but I think we have to consider the ways in which reconstruction and development and preservation do not necessarily invalidate the authenticity of the site. I think it's incumbent upon places like Auschwitz to be very transparent with their visitors about what has changed since the past, since 1945. So that the authenticity is in the honesty of the presentation of the site, both in terms of its history during the Holocaust, but also in terms of its post-history, the post-Holocaust history. So it's nearly 80-year existence now as a memorial site is part of the story. I think the other part of the concern about the theme park is that how it relegates tourists to the position of people who are basically thrill seekers or bad actors in terms of Holocaust memory, whose interests in the site are not sincere implicitly, and who may be sort of motivated by some kind of morbid curiosity. And even if that were the case, and I don't doubt that one could find examples of those kinds of travelers, but I'm hesitant to therefore suggest that the majority of tourists to places like Auschwitz fit that description. Even if that were the case, I think the visit to the camp memorial can be quite stunning, quite transformational for many visitors. And I want to take seriously the impact of visit to a place like Auschwitz and many of the other camp memorials, but also museums and other memorial sites. I want to take seriously the impact those kinds of visits can have. And I think the term theme park does a disservice to those serious experiences that many people vouch for.
I want to turn to talking about tourists and the perception of tourists and tourism. It's a theme that is traced throughout the book. And you even mentioned at the beginning of our conversation today how when you were initially visiting these sites, you would, in your head, you were going as an educator, not as a tourist. So it seems to me, especially now as I was reading your book, it seems to me that much of the criticism about Holocaust tourism rests on the extremely negative perceptions of tourists. And almost like anti-Americanism is what it sort of seemed like to me at times, which you do mention in the book. And tourists are sometimes rightly perceived as vulgar, frivolous, inappropriate, superficial, and ill-prepared to visit these sites. But as you sort of just were discussing, that certainly isn't always the case, that's for sure. So where did this negative perception of tourism and tourists come from? And is there a connection to this perception with a sort of an anti-American sort of feeling?
Thank you. That's a question that I still engage with. I think the answer to this, where does this negative perception of tourists come from, I think really has to be looked at in the longer history of tourism in general. So if we think about the origins of modern tourism anyway, we think about, most scholars will point to the Grand Tour, which was the educational tour that young, usually men from upper middle classes would take at the end of their education to sort of complete their maturation by traveling abroad and encountering sites of cultural importance, practicing their language skills. And it was a sign of having achieved a certain educational status and was the preserve of the well-to-do for the most part. And so when the advent of mass travel comes onto the scene with modern technology, industrialization, urbanization, and eventually, of course, plane travel, I think the entry of the masses into the tourist realm upset this notion we might have had of tourism as a space, the preserve of the well-to-do elite, who saw tourism as education, often without kind of a more critical look at the, you know, inherently colonialist aspects of tourism. So that's where I would see the origins of the negative perception. And you know, again, there all of these characterizations. There's of course some basis, some legitimate basis in reality for the negative perceptions. There are certainly tourist practices that one could take exception to, particularly around some of the more, some aspects of tourism, the so-called 3S tourism, the sea, sun, and sand, that are often don't reveal tourists at their best. But tourism is a very diverse practice. It's what the UNESCO calls the world's largest industry. There are so many forms of tourism, so many new and emerging forms of tourism that I think to just characterize tourism in general, even mass tourism, by one variant of it is problematic. And, you know, as an American who I grew up in a family that was able to do some very interesting international travel, because of a father who was in the military and stationed overseas, you know, I became very aware of the perception of the ugly American, as we say, the American tourist, and have encountered such a tourist on a few occasions myself. So I understand where the stereotype comes from. I do think the stereotype of the American tourist with the sort of Hawaiian t-shirt and the camera around the neck and speaking too loudly, I think that names a more general anxiety that comes around the fact that tourism is a global phenomenon. And so the way in which Americans, the American presence in tourism is kind of has a global reach. At the same time, though, other travelers participate in this enterprise, this global enterprise. And I think Americanization or American becomes a shorthand way of referring to the troubling aspects of globalization. If we think of globalization as homogenization, as the sort of the spread of Hollywood values of and aesthetics to the rest of the world, I think that is often named as American, even though other places participate in the very same phenomenon and often are the origins of that phenomenon. So I think I do think it names something that is not really just American. I think America certainly has plays a figurative role in that kind of dealing with this more global phenomenon. In which the United States no doubt plays a major role, but is by no means a unilateral relationship. It's more complex. There are other players involved. And I think I want to get at some of the ways in which globalization, and modern technologies are transforming experiences in ways that can't really be reduced to parallels with perceived notions of American culture.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit amazon.com/prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
I want to transition to talking specifically about the museums that you talk about in the book. With regards to, I guess, memorialization more broadly, museums, well, as you're well aware, are not neutral. They tell a very carefully crafted story. And certain events, people, or perspectives may be prioritized over others, resulting in vastly divergent memorializations of the Holocaust. So I'm wondering if you could elaborate on this and how Holocaust museums differ in the stories that they tell.
Sure. So I think the maybe I'll try to pick examples from. So my book focuses in particular on sites in the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, Yad Vashem in Jerusalem, various sites in Warsaw, the Ghetto Museum, for example, the Ghetto Uprising, the Warsaw Uprising Museum, among other places, and also Berlin's memorial landscape. So if I think of each of those places and some of the major sites that are located in them, they are often thought of as becoming a part of what some scholars have called a civil religion. So I think this is especially the case for when discussing Yad Vashem. So what role does the memory of the Holocaust play in the establishment of a kind of national narrative of Israel? And the Yad Vashem site, which was thoroughly remodeled, redesigned in the early 2000s, is very much a narrative. It's not neutral. It starts with life of Ashkenazi Jews in Europe at the beginning, and then moves through the Holocaust in a spatial and chronological way. So that near the end of the museum, we have an appreciation of the devastation and destruction that was visited upon Europe's Jews. But then the museum continues, and at the end, one walks out onto this balcony and just onto this amazing, beautiful landscape of trees, of cedar trees outside in the outskirts of Jerusalem. And it's a very redemptive site. A very restorative site, and so the narrative there, of course, is that is Israel as a response to the attempted destruction of Europe's of Jews, as a statement of survival and even thriving, and that becomes an important part of what some would call a civil religion as opposed to a theological religion. That same term has been used to think about the role of the Holocaust in America's self-understanding. And when one goes to the museum in Washington, D.C., the first quotes that are on the door are from U.S. soldiers who participated in the liberation of the Ohrdruf camp, Eisenhower, a part of the Buchenwald camp system. The eagerness in the sort of American imagination to identify with the liberator also is a non-neutral way of remembering the Holocaust that plays into certain notions, mythology that America creates about itself and its role in the world. But that shouldn't obscure from the efforts the museum makes to also call attention to the ways that the United States and other Western countries failed to step up to accept Jewish refugees, to intervene more early and forcefully to stop the Holocaust in its tracks, to make the Holocaust a a priority in the war effort. And so, again, another example of a place that's not neutral. If we go to Berlin, we have a very interesting problem, and that is, how does the site of the city, that basically one book calls, refers to Berlin as the capital of the Holocaust. It was the administrative hub of the Holocaust. How does a place so closely associated with the perpetrator memorialize its crimes? This is a question that James E. Young has asked in his many groundbreaking studies. And it's requires a different kind of response. It would be quite unlike the American identification with the liberator or the sort of more redemptive ending in the establishment of Israel in Yad Vashem. The German case has to really focus on the devastation of loss, but also the responsibility that lies with perpetrators. And so there can be no redemptive happy ending embodied in any kind of memorial museum in Germany. The Jewish Museum in Berlin is a good example of a museum who, in its very architecture, tries to avoid to really inscribe the permanence of loss, the loss of Berlin's Jewish community. The vast majority of its Jewish members, by having a void that runs through the entire building. So there are actually parts of the building that cannot be accessed because they are walled off from the rest of the museum. One has to walk around these empty spaces. And that emptiness is meant to convey the permanent loss that one has inflicted on that Germany inflicted on itself in the Holocaust. And then finally, in Poland, so I think there's a recent museum that was that opened a few years ago called Polin, the History of Polish Jews, which is a nearly 1,000-year history, and it tries to recover and recall the richness of Jewish culture in Poland. It is not a primarily a Holocaust museum. But if one goes to a nearby museum, which is the ghetto, rather the Warsaw Uprising Museum or the Warsaw Rising Museum, there the focus is not on the Holocaust either, but rather on Polish resistance to the Nazi occupation, and the Holocaust figures as a part of that, but it doesn't really engage with the Holocaust as a separate event. So I think we can see in memorialization efforts in Poland very often a difficulty at coming to terms with Poland's difficult position as victims of the Third Reich, and then later occupied by the Soviet Union and a system of communism imposed on it from Moscow. So there are the genuine and legitimate sense of Polish victimization, but also the problem of Polish perpetration. So not that the state was directing perpetration because the Polish state had been liquidated, but we know that many Poles participated in the persecution and even murder of their Jewish neighbors, as Jan T. Gross points out in his groundbreaking works. So I think tourists should be attentive to the different national contexts that inform different memorial and museum sites at various places. And I would encourage them to be skeptical and ask questions and look for ambiguities, because there are very few places that have that, you know, where this history is can be told so in such a straightforward national narrative.
I'm particularly curious about the redemptive narrative of Yad Vashem. What's interesting too, you talk about it in the book, is not only when you explain how when you come out of the museum, you just explained it here, you see the Jerusalem hills and it's very beautiful. So this idea of redemption, it's also where it's placed, right? Right near Mount Herzl. So it continues the story anyhow. Was there backlash to this redemptive narrative? Because I would imagine that could be troubling to some folks to see the Holocaust interpreted and presented in this way.
I don't know if I could say backlash in particular, but I do think that it's a contested way of remembering the Holocaust. I think that it's it's the kind of implicit narrative. I mean, scholars refer to museums as narrative spaces. So we kind of enter and proceed through a story and exit at the end. And so the story that's told through the visit to Yad Vashem could not be replicated somewhere else. So on the one hand, I think it's understood that it's understandable why that redemptive narrative, that particular redemptive narrative, is told where it is. But it's also, you know, memory of the Holocaust in Israel and elsewhere can be mobilized for other issues. I think that is something that sort of haunts the edges of places like Yad Vashem, where people may have come with questions about other kinds of events. I mean, I think one thinks in particular about the relationship between Palestinian Israelis and Jewish Israelis, and the occupation. I think that some have suggested that needs to also be encountered at the museum, and by not acknowledging that the aspects of Israel's founding that have to do with what Palestinians will call the disaster, the Nakba, that somehow that's an erasure. I'm not taking a position on that. I do think that that every narrative is a choice that includes certain elements and excludes others. And I think it's incumbent upon visitors really to bring that kind of critical lens to the place. No memorial site, no museum can capture the entirety of the historical intricacies around a single event and address all of the issues that lie at the parameter of it. But I think one can be attentive to what's included and what's excluded in the narrative at a museum.
So we've focused most of our discussion on large museums and memorials. And I wanted to shift a little bit just to talk about less developed sites. We alluded to this before earlier. And less developed in the sense that there are some memorial sites where there's nothing left, but they're developed some way into a memorial site. And there are some sites that are interspersed within a city. So it just makes it different. Navigating that site is different. So I'm just wondering if you can maybe explain some of these sites and sort of what these less developed, maybe less visited, I would assume maybe, sites mean for Holocaust remembrance.
Thinking about the more remote sites. So I talk in particular in the chapter on Poland about the camp memorials at Sobibor and Belzec, which are both on the border with Belarus and Ukraine, respectively. And they're very difficult to reach. They're near small, tiny villages. There's no major urban center close by. So it requires great effort to access these spaces. And I think that speaks to the seriousness with which visitors to these sites take them, that they're willing to make the effort to find them. And I think often what happens when one, I remember my first visits to Sobibor in particular, was I was stunned by the sense of desolation at the site. It was very underdeveloped as a memorial. It was overgrown by nature. It's hidden in a forest. But I also found that profoundly meaningful because that spoke to the intended clandestineness of the Holocaust. The Nazis did not want the crimes to be discovered. The Sobibor and the other Operation Reinhardt camps were built to be temporary, to run until they had accomplished their horrible mission, and then to be dismantled and erased, often plowed under, so that no trace of the crimes could be found after the war. And I found the sense of neglect or this underdevelopment to speak to that nature of the Holocaust, but also to speak to the amnesia that has often accompanied Holocaust memory. Certainly, the desire to forget is made palpable when you go to a place like that. There are presently efforts to redesign and build up the memorial site at Sobibor, including a permanent museum and other installations that of a more permanent nature. And while I understand that impulse, I also have some concern that it transformed the site into something using an architectural idiom of permanence, when the actual original architecture the centers, the death camps, were meant to be temporary structures. We see this at the present day Belzec camp memorial, which is a field of cement and rebar, a sort of stylized field of rubble that looks like it will be there for eternity. And while it marks as the site as a permanent resting place for the hundreds of thousands of victims who perished there, who were murdered there, I think it, again, alters maybe the perception of the place itself as something that was intended to be temporary and makes it look as if it was permanent. And I would hate to have any visitor kind of come away with a sense of the permanence of some grim accomplishment by the Nazis. I think that would be unfortunate. If I turn to the question of dispersal throughout an urban landscape, I think that's also a fascinating phenomenon. Berlin has places throughout the city that mark deportation sites, where synagogues once stood, where neighborhoods that had thriving Jewish communities, buildings where the location where the buildings of the Gestapo and the SS and all of Himmler's administrative apparatus were located. So it's dispersed throughout the city. And so you have, for example, the stumbling stones the artist Günter Demnig has placed in many European cities, certainly plenty of them in Berlin, that remind you as a visitor how the Holocaust was not just a very centralized event, but was very dispersed, and how it could pervade a cityscape and indeed an entire country, the geography of an entire country. So I think becoming aware of the variety of sites that one can visit that memorialize the Holocaust also helps one appreciate the profound expanse of the Holocaust, its bureaucratic reach, it's the cultural devastation that brought about. One can say the same thing about sites in Krakow or Warsaw, which may not be easy to find, in particular the ghetto wall in Warsaw. There are very few remnant pieces of the wall standing. But with the right guide or the right homework on the part of the tourist, one can find locations dispersed throughout the city that had some bearing on the history, on the unfolding of the Holocaust and the experience of the Holocaust. And so I think that is something that tourism in particular is uniquely able to do, is give visitors a sense of the spatial reach of the Holocaust and help one try to begin to comprehend just the enormity of the event and all of its meanings.
We're approaching the end of our interview, but I have two final questions. This one's a bit general, but what can we learn about collective memory and Holocaust remembrance through an examination of Holocaust memorials and museums?
Yeah, I think that what we can learn is that the nature of Holocaust memory or collective memory in general is not fixed. It's fluid. It changes over time. It has to address the needs of the present as well as recall the events of the past. And so even though we often think of memorials and museums as permanent structures and that will enshrine a particular memory, and that's certainly the intent of sort of more classical monumental national memorial sites, think of the Washington Monument any of those kinds of sites. I think it's incumbent upon Holocaust memorial sites to reflect the evolving nature of our knowledge about the Holocaust, so the evolving questions that we have about the Holocaust. So if I think, for example, of the early years of Holocaust memorial sites, a number of things have changed. First of all, the Cold War context of Holocaust memorials, in which the Holocaust became an illustration of the evils either of totalitarianism from a Western perspective or capitalist inflected fascism from the perspective of the Eastern European memorials. We've left that behind. But at the same time, in those early years, often particularly in the Eastern memorials, the unique experience, the fate of Jewish victims of the Holocaust was radically underemphasized or virtually erased. And it's only been since the 80s that, and particularly after the end of the Cold War in the 90s, that these sites have really come to terms and acknowledged that the vast majority of victims at these sites were European Jews. I think another thing that we have observed over time is that the role of imagery at these sites has undergone a lot of change. I think the early reliance on the typical atrocity image of mounds of corpses, for example, or emaciated survivors has tended to be replaced in more recent times by less shocking kinds of images that don't risk alienating a viewer, but instead try to speak to some other aspect of the Holocaust that's that requires reflection and cognition. So documents about deportations or accoutrements of as what Barbie Zeller calls accoutrements of murder. So cans of Zyklon B or the prisoner uniforms, but without re-objectifying the victims of the Holocaust by objectifying their image once again through the perpetrator lens. So those standards of memorialization change over time. The questions we have about the Holocaust change over time. I think we are much more concerned than we used to be with the question of the perpetrator. How is it that somebody can participate in an event like the Holocaust? So the attention always needs to rest with the victims, I think we need to pay attention to the perpetrator also, and telling that trying to come to some understanding of the nature of the perpetrator at Holocaust memorial sites is a relatively more recent event. So I think all of those can be discovered. The ever-changing nature of Holocaust memory itself can be observed if one engages with the history of these sites. And that's why I also hope that the sites themselves tell the story of not only of the Holocaust and the events that happened there, but of their own history as memorials, because I think that's a very rich and informative history to also share with the public.
So we've reached the end of our interview, but I have one final question for you. What are you working on now?
Well, I am still interested in the question of Holocaust memory and tourism's role in it in particular, but I'm also becoming more, I'm very interested in the way that memorialization of the Holocaust has influenced efforts to come to terms with other catastrophic events, and in particular with other genocides. So I am beginning to explore and study the ways in which genocide memorials related to, say, the Armenian genocide or the Rwandan genocide or to apartheid in South Africa or slavery in the U.S., to what extent are those memorialization efforts shaped by or informed by efforts to memorialize the Holocaust? Do the same questions about what's appropriate to show or what's not appropriate to show, what can be understood and what cannot be understood, all of these kinds of questions. I'm very curious to see how these kinds of questions are shared actually across other kinds of catastrophic events. So I'm at the beginning stages of that. Will take me probably quite some time to come to I hope to develop a book project out of it. But in the short term, I'm hoping to have an article or two to be completed within the year. And I imagine.
Well, that sounds like a fascinating project and an interesting, I guess, segue or continuation of Postcards from Auschwitz. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you. I hope so. It's a difficult topic, but it's one that I think requires engagement and there's a lot to learn from it. So
yes, absolutely.
Take it on. So.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me today about your book. I really enjoyed reading it and thoroughly enjoyed this interview. So thank you so much. Postcards from Auschwitz, Holocaust Tourism and the Meaning of Remembrance is out now, and I highly recommend it. It's a super fascinating and intriguing read. Thank you so much, Daniel.
Thank you, Lindsay. I appreciated the conversation. Thank you.